Good afternoon to everyone. And greetings to all of those listening in. This month that we're in, fact, this very day that we're in right now, it started on the 16th of December, which would have been Monday, I believe, the 75th anniversary of what is known as the Battle of the Bulge. It was actually the most costly battle of all World War II, I believe, for American soldiers. If you're interested, Mr. Bremer, there's a little handout there that shows what took place to some degree, if Willie wants to pass it out to whoever be interested. But what it was, the American forces underneath the command of Dwight David Eisenhower landed on D-Day on the shores of France, Normandy, and several other places, the different beaches that they landed on. That was on June the 6th, I believe, 1944. And then gradually, the Allied forces, American, British, some Canadians, and other ones, gradually pushed their way through France. Then they liberated the city of Paris on August the 25th of 1944. And the Germans were being pushed back. They had them pushed back quite a ways. The Allied forces were pushing towards the West Wall, which was the western border of Germany. And they had that greatly reinforced with pillboxes and bunkers and everything there. The Allies were pushing towards that. In that West Wall, the Germans had a great amount of fortifications, but the Allies were pushing on. And it was believed by the Allied command that the Germans would put up a vicious defense, but the Germans were not capable of any more great offenses whatsoever, that they would be hard to beat, but they wouldn't be challenging the Allies anymore. Well, that turned out to not be true at all. If you have that little handout there, you'll see the red one shows the movement of the German troops against the Allies. That blue line there, that more solid blue line, is where the front was. Well, the Germans were not giving up. Called the Ardennes Offensive, it is known as the Battle of the Bulge. It gets that name from the standpoint that there was this line of defense with the German line, I should say the front, and it was a solid front where the Germans thrust against it and it bulged that line in. That's where that name came from. It wasn't a location, it was the bulge in the front. Well, this Battle of the Bulge, referring to that bulge, its aim was to cut the Allied advance on the West Wall and to cut into the Allied forces to capture the port of Antwerp and basically be able to devastate the American forces and British forces that were there. For the Germans, the Ardennes, it's a heavily forested area. Nobody would expect the attack at that point. It was a forest, a very dense forest, and it would not be where you would expect an attack. It had very few major roads, and the Germans decided that was the best place to try, as this was the weakest area on the Allied front. In that area, there were a lot of recuperating Allied forces, and a lot of new troops were in that area. The battle lines would be within the forest itself, within that very forest. The German armies would be thrown into the attack. There was four different armies that they would throw into that, two panzer divisions, which are your major tanks, and two armies with all their artillery. The plan called for complete surprise, and the Allies were caught completely unprepared. It called for complete surprise in the dead of winter, temperatures, you know, extremely cold, sub-freezing, obviously, and a rapid advance, and the purpose was to overwhelm and to capture as much as they could. Particularly, they wanted to capture as much fuel that the Allies had because they needed that to keep those panzer divisions, keep advancing. On average, the Americans suffered 2,000 casualties every day during that offense. And it started the 16th of December, and it ran into January, actually, before it was completely wrapped and mopped up. The Americans ended up losing 20,000 dead, over 60,000 wounded and captured. And this was the battle that was never going to happen because the Allies did not think it would happen. Germany, Hitler had his plans. He had his plans. It was one of the volumes I was reading through. There's this American medic during the Battle of the Bulge. He had treated quite a few injured Americans, and then they had some prisoners of war, the German prisoners, and was treating them after they treated the Americans. They would help the Germans as well. And he was treating this one German soldier, and the German soldier said, "Is it permitted to talk to you?" And the American medic said, "Yes, what's on your mind?" He said, "Well, where are you from?" He said, "Well, I'm from the U.S. "What part of the U.S.?" "Well, the Northeast." And the German was very inquiring. He said, "Where in the Northeast?" And he said, "Connecticut." I said, "Where in Connecticut?" And the German did, in perfect English. And he said, "Waterbury, Connecticut." "Ah," the German said, "ah, yes, Waterbury is at the junction of the Naugatuck and the Mad Rivers." And the American medic says, "How could you possibly know that?" And the young German soldier said, "Well, I was in training for the administration." "The administration of what?" the medic said. "The administration of territories." So the German, their plan was they would take America. And this person, this soldier, knew Connecticut, and he'd been trained to administer that area when the Germans were finally successful. That's just a little side note. But German plans were to conquer. Well, in order to create as much panic and uncertainty as possible during this attack, in the U.S. ranks, teams of English-speaking German troops were infiltrated behind the American lines. They were wearing U.S. uniforms in order to disrupt troop movements and spread rumors. So they could speak English, had American uniforms on, and their whole purpose was just to create disorder behind the line. Well, the purpose today, brethren, as we go through this, to study this historical event that was taking place at this very moment, 75 years ago. And actually, I'll point something out here right now. My wife's father was in that battle. My wife's father was in that battle. And I have here a copy. It was made. It says Kane, which is my wife's maiden name. And it was issued to him. And it says, the 3rd Battalion, and he was wounded in that battle. He was wounded. The 3rd Battalion, 395th Infantry Regiment, is cited for outstanding performance of duty in action against the enemy during the period of 16 to 19 December 1944 near Hofen, Germany, during the German offensive of the Ardennes. The 3rd Battalion, 395th Infantry Regiment, was assigned the mission of holding several different roads there during 4 infantry attacks. I'll make a long story short here, but they were one of the few units who did not give one inch. Where the Americans, you see that picture, you see that bulge where it went way in, they held their ground against savage attack after savage attack. I'll try to pick up a little bit of it here. Several times they actually called artillery on their own positions in order to beat back the Germans. But I'll actually lay that commendation on the back table if anybody cared to look at it. And my wife's father was 20 years old during that time, 20 years old, and one of the few units who did not give any ground at all. But anyway, they planted these people. The Germans infiltrated these troops behind the line, and we could look at that and we can draw lessons from that, can't we? We can think of several different things. No wonder, as we read in Scripture, no wonder for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. It's one of Satan's ways to infiltrate, get behind the lines, spread confusion and rumors and stuff like that. It becomes disheartening to the American troops, right? Because they would spread rumors about great German advances, because they would be talking as if they were an Allied soldier and say, "Oh, we hear the Germans have already overtaken this area," and just to create fear and panic in it. Well, at 05:30 on December 16th, the German artillery opened fire and blasted the U.S. troop positions up and down that 85-mile front for nearly an hour before the assaulting armies moved off their start lines. Surprise was absolutely total. Some entire U.S. regiments were surrendering to the sudden German attack. And again, there was several thousand American soldiers were billeted in that area in civilian houses. They had three-day passes. They were off in the forest hunting and stuff like that because there was going to be no more attack. The Germans couldn't possibly launch an offensive. So it was recreation to a certain degree. The Allies had learned through bitter experience that the Germans could still mount an effective defense, but as I said earlier, they did not believe that another full-scale enemy offensive was even possible. We become, as human beings, lulled to sleep. The Germans were suffering 3,000 casualties a day, and intelligence said that they were thin, brittle, and vulnerable. So there was a relaxed atmosphere. As the Germans attacked in the Ardennes Forest on the morning of the 16th, just to show you how confident the Allies were that something like this could never happen, when they attacked, Dwight Eisenhower, who was newly promoted, he had led the D-Day invasion, Dwight Eisenhower, newly promoted to the rank of five-star general, was attending his valet's wedding at his Versailles headquarters. General Bradley and Hodge were visiting a Belgian gunmaker to order a pair of custom-made shotguns. General Montgomery was playing golf in Holland, convinced that the Germans could no longer stage a major offensive operation. There's no danger. He planned to go home for Christmas, as he said, unless things become more exciting. Well, German artillery had cut telephone communications and headquarters were far from the front. So it was not until late afternoon that the Allied commanders began to get fragmentary reports suggesting just how exciting the war had all of a sudden become. Totally unexpected attack. The Battle of the Bulge had begun. It would be the biggest battle of the war on the Western Front, and it was completely unexpected. The attack began. The GIs, as I mentioned, the GIs were resting. Hundreds of Germans swarming towards the Americans, some in gray, probably seen pictures of them if you look very much at World War II, some wearing these gray great coats that they would wear, some dressed in white for fighting in the snow. There were thousands of young Americans who were stationed in the Ardennes during the fall and winter of 1944. They knew little and cared less about questions of grand strategy. They just relished the comparative tranquility of the Ardennes. "Lucky guys," one veteran shouted to a newcomer, "you're coming into a rest camp." That's how peaceful it was. You're coming into a rest camp. General Hodges' First Army headquarters was spread out among casinos and handsome old hotels in the once fashionable Belgian resort town of Spa. GIs on three-day passes hunted deer and wild boar in the forest, or boxed, or went to movies at Malady or one of the other 10 official rest areas in Belgium and Luxembourg. Marlena Dietrich, she was an actress back at that time, she was entertaining the troops, so it's a very relaxed atmosphere. Totally unexpected that there would be any intrusion upon that fall at all. And we could turn, brethren, to 1 Thessalonians, and we can remind ourselves of a caution that was written by the Apostle Paul in his letter here to the Thessalonians, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. And verse 1. "But concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you, for you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them, as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape." The principle I'm drawing out here, the temptation to relax and to think there's no real harm, is the part that I was reading there, brethren. They were off hunting wild boar and deer in the forest because there was no longer going to be a threat. We had already basically won. The Americans thought, regarding the Germans, one gentleman wrote, "They were supposed to be beaten. We were there resting up, and we weren't disturbing them, and they weren't supposed to disturb us." That was their view. They did not understand the German mentality and that of war. Luke 12:19 tells us, let's turn there for a moment just to draw some principles out from this. Luke 12 and verse 19, the story of the rich fool, remember? He built his barns bigger and bigger. And we'll just take verse 19 there in Luke 12. "And I will say to my soul," this is after he says, "I'll build the bigger barns and I'll put all that I've secured and grown and produced in there. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry." That's a tendency that we have, understandable. But there's a warning. There's a warning we can gather just by studying the Battle of the Bulge. Because the big battles were over. We would just be pushing quietly forward from now on. Similar scenes as this were taking place, this assault, were taking place up and down the 85-mile front. The German infantry's task was to overwhelm, to just overwhelm, bring a sense of hopelessness upon all involved. When the attack began at this one point, the captain was hit, so was the first lieutenant. Shortly after the attack began at this one location, the first sergeant ran up to this one gentleman named Galloway to tell Galloway what had happened and asked him for orders. I knew we were in trouble when the sergeant was asking me, a second lieutenant, what to do. If you have any military experience, you would understand that. The second lieutenants, or the second Louis, as they called them, kind of fresh out of school, and the sergeants, they had experience on the ground, and the lieutenants were kind of like, okay. But here, the sergeant is coming to the lieutenant and asking. It said, the sergeant was asking me, a second lieutenant, what to do. He remembered, they never asked second lieutenants anything. I said, I'm going home to Alabama. You can stay here and figure it out. See you later. Well, in fact, Galloway never went anywhere. Instead, he took charge, ordering his unit to move a howitzer into place on the east side of town in the hope that they would be able to fire at point-blank range into the advancing Germans. The enemy overran it before they could even load it and fire. A sudden destruction. Galloway and the rest of the battery fought on as infantrymen. You just had waves of Germans coming at you, he recalled. We had one machine gun going, just mowing them down. They kept coming right down the road, right into the machine gun. But there were waves and waves and waves of them. Again, the mission was to overwhelm, At mid-morning, four U.S. tanks turned up and helped take the gun back. Battery C kept firing sporadically for the rest of the day and into the night, Galloway remembered. One thing I worried, this gentleman Galloway says at this point, one thing I'd worried about before I got over there into the European theater, was whether I would know what to do at the right time. And, of course, that came home to roost with me, because at one point, the first night of the Battle of the Bulge, there I was trying to figure out tactics. And to be perfectly honest, I figured as a junior officer in the artillery, I would be a forward observer, and I didn't have to worry about tactics too much. And as it ended up, here I am in charge and thinking to myself, why did I sleep through tactics? I could have been prepared. In other words, he could have been prepared for the job that was thrust upon him. That's how life is, brethren. Sometimes you get thrust in places you never anticipated and never expected. But if we do our homework on an ongoing basis, you know, we can handle, with God's help, obviously, handle things. Well, there was a great battle was going on for one location, the battle for Bastogne. As the 101st Airborne moved towards Bastogne, past a line of vehicles hurrying the other way. So the 101st, they bring it in the 101st Airborne, but they're being deployed by vehicle at this time. And they're heading in to help at the Battle of Bastogne. Well, going the other way is a Jeep bringing some major or somebody out, maybe running a mission or something. I didn't pick up that part of it. But a major in the Jeep that was heading away from the battle as the 101st are heading in, he says, "You'll never stop them, boys," referring to the German troops. And this is the attitude that the soldiers had. This is the attitude God's people need to have. The major said, "You'll never stop them, boys." One of the paratroopers shouted back, "We're going to have a try at it, sir." In other words, no defeatism. No defeatism at all. On December 19th, Eisenhower, this is December 19th, has been going on for 3 days. Eisenhower, the commanding five-star general, Eisenhower met with his generals at Verdun. Eisenhower remained unshaken. He remained unshaken. And they were going to have a conference. Eisenhower remained unshaken. He would have only cheerful faces at the table as they discussed the situation. He would have only cheerful faces at his table. He insisted the German offensive should be seen as opportunity for us and not as a disaster. Attitude is everything. Attitude is everything. General Patton, as they try to bring their forces and bear down upon this, which initially would appear as a disaster, General Patton would wheel his forces 90 degrees to the left, and he would move some 133,000 tanks, trucks, and other vehicles 100 miles northward. And when Eisenhower asked me about it, Patton says, I'll have them there in 72 hours. It's determination. It's determination is what it is. Asked to surrender, this one general, McGuffliff, I'm sure I pronounced that right. They were surrounded. They were being bombarded. And the Germans set a couple of their soldiers up there carrying white flags. And they brought to this general, our commander is asking or commanding you to surrender at this time. And the general, very famous response, he just wrote back, nuts, not surrendering. Well, the note was given to the two messengers who came up there. The note said, nuts. And they said, what does this mean? And the messenger of General McGuffer says, it means the same as go to hell. So in other words, we're not surrendering. We're simply not surrendering. So the battle rages on. Many factors were involved. It was snowy. It was muddy. It was freezing cold. And all this battle was going on in the midst of a heavily forested area. Narrow roads with difficult terrain. This slowed the advancing Germans. Another factor slowed them, as it was recorded in one of the volumes I was going through. The weather slowed them, but another thing that slowed the advancing Germans was the extraordinary tenacity of otherwise ordinary GIs. Just the tenacity of soldiers who did their duty. As Corey was mentioning in the first message there, the last of a vanishing breed, as he mentioned about John. And these were young men who found what their role was and filled their role. Again, the example of the unit that my father-in-law served in during that time. Just ordinary people. He was from Alabama, as just some brought in, drafted into the service, but it was held up by the extraordinary tenacity of just otherwise ordinary GIs. In the end, the fighting, the holding, and the winning would have to be done by the guy on the line, the individual on the line. I don't have data here in front of me, but it may have been the first day they launched that offensive. They came across these Allied trucks, these American trucks moving some troops. There was a German tank. They took out the first truck, and they took out the second truck, and then they captured 150 American soldiers at that point in time. It came to be known as the Malady Massacre. They, about 100 of them that survived the initial attack, they took them out in a field, and an SS officer went up there, shot the first couple with his pistol in their head, and then they just opened up the machine guns and mowed down. Roughly 90 or 100 American soldiers were just massacred right there at that point. Some amazingly, they fell to the snow. The SS officers would walk through and kick them, and if they moaned or groaned or anything, they would put another bullet in their head. But there was a few that survived and, of course, told the tale. The word got out of what happened. Of course, that incensed the Allied armies and inspired them even more. Fighting in the snow, but they fought on. They fought on. As Jesus said in Luke 17:10, so likewise you should say, when you've done all those things that were commanded of you, say, we have done what it is our duty to do. And that's all. You just go on and do more. You do more. And that's what many of those soldiers did. The weather, reading from another portion that I took, the weather was so terrible, one officer recalled. It was white when you looked down. It was white when you looked up. It was white when you looked out that way. Many men shivered in light uniforms. Winter clothing, woolen socks, and waterproof boots did not reach the front until mid-January. This is mid-December when the battle started. M1 rifles froze. Ground fog and snow sometimes made it hard to see more than a few feet. Drifted snow quickly exhausted men who tried to move through it in no more than a few yards. You had no possessions at all. One gentleman, Paul Russell, remembered, you would cut everything down to the simplest you had to carry. That was their survival. You didn't carry anything you didn't have to. Everything. So we were marching from one horror to another, because it was just one battle after another. We were marching from one horror to another. I had shoe packs on because the ground was always wet and frozen. One gentleman relates a story who he had the opportunity to get some sleep. He just laid out on the ground there someplace. And sometime later, he woke up, and he couldn't get himself off the ground because he had become frozen to the ground. So he had to be jerked up because he was frozen to the terrain that he was sleeping on. I had two pairs of woolen socks in my pockets. I carried a couple of boxes of K rations, that's a military food, canned food that they had. I never had a toothbrush at all. I didn't take a shower for 6 months. I always had plenty of cigarettes. They were free in the Army if you were out on the line where you were sort of tempted to smoke. I had a sleeping bag, which I carried with a rope over my shoulder like a tramp, and that's all I had. No change of underwear at all, no change of clothes at all for months. Everybody smelled terrible, but since we all did, you didn't notice it. Those who could grow beards did. I didn't shave yet. He wasn't old enough to even shave, but here he is out there in the midst of that. But this was an interesting point, brethren. The best way an infantryman could protect himself overnight, they had to dig in through the night, dig their foxholes. So the best way an infantryman could protect himself overnight was digging a slit trench between two foxholes. So you can picture these two individuals have their foxhole, which they get in down inside. But the best way to survive was dig a slit trench between those two foxholes, getting together with your buddy back to back, so that your buddy protects your rear and you protect his. You're as safe as your buddy can make you by being able to see what you cannot see. So they would cut that slit trench back to back. He could see your back, you could see his back. Obviously, brethren, I think there's a lesson in there for us to learn. Ecclesiastes, let's go to Ecclesiastes 4. Ecclesiastes chapter 4 and verse 9. Ecclesiastes 4, 9. Again, these are lessons, brethren. We study some of these things of history, and you know, principles, scriptural principles jump out at you, and you see them acted out before your very eyes. Ecclesiastes 4 and verse 9, two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. So there's value in that closeness. That reminds me, this is away from the Battle of the Bulge, it reminds me when I was reading sometime back, looking into a little bit the Battle of the Alamo. Isn't it San Antonio, Texas, I believe? The Battle of the Alamo, February, March, 1836, Santa Anna, the Mexican general, and I believe he was the dictator of Mexico at that time. Mexico had recently got its freedom from Spain, and the Texans were trying to break free of Mexico and form their own government there. Well, Santa Anna had 2,000 or greater man force. Well, inside the Alamo was 185 men, 180, 185, I'm not sure. Santa Anna demands surrender. He sends a message there demanding that they surrender. His demand was answered with cannon fire, and the battle began. Colonel Travis, who was in charge, was killed shortly into the battle. And at that point, as this one gentleman said, after Colonel Travis was killed, there were then 180 separate battles being fought. But each man had his position. He defended his position. Of course, we know the Mexicans won, and there was a great slaughter, and there was another slaughter to place after that. But the Texans went on to win. And it says in there, each man as the slaughter, as the Alamo was being overrun, said, each man found courage from the man at his side. He found courage from the man next to him. There's one Stanley McChrystal, who was the general in charge of the NATO forces in Afghanistan 15 or so years ago. He made the comment, he says, men, people are not always courageous by themselves. They're courageous together. You draw courage from one another. You draw courage from one another. Each man found courage, as with the Alamo, as in the Ardennes Forest as well. Each man found courage from the man at his side. You get courage from your commitment. You get courage from your commitment. You rise to protect those about you. You get courage from those about you. You rise to protect those about you. You can draw courage from those about you, and those about you can draw courage from you. How you handle the situation, how you handle the situation. After the Battle of the Bulge, It was now time to push on. This is interesting, the insight into human nature. Look at it that way. After the Battle of the Bulge, the Germans were eventually, that bulge was pushed back, and the Americans and the British forces and the others with them would eventually make their way to the Rhine River and into Berlin, and we know the Germans were beat back. But after the Battle of the Bulge, it was now time to push on, punch through the West Wall, that great German defense that they had built up, reach the Rhine, and end this war. Well, once again, Field Marshal, I think is the title he had, or General, I'm not sure, the Montgomery, from what I gather, Montgomery was pretty filled with Montgomery. He seemed to be a pretty egotistical man, when sometimes people in those positions, that's what it takes. You know, God has different tools that he uses for different jobs. You know, a shrinking violet isn't necessarily going to rise to the level of a general. It takes a certain characteristic about these men. But anyway, Montgomery, as the Battle of the Ardennes Forest, the Battle of the Bulge, is behind him now, and it's time to push forward. Well, once again, General Montgomery sought the spotlight. He wanted the spotlight. He wanted to be the one that led the troops to cross the Rhine. He wanted to lead a single drive into Germany. He wanted all American forces not under his command to stay put. So Montgomery would be the one leading the charge. He wanted that notoriety. Well, Generals Bradley and Patton were infuriated by that because they too, you know, some of these men, they wanted their glory. Well, Patton and Bradley were infuriated about that. Bradley threatened to resign if Montgomery was given command of any more of his forces. Human nature, we were coming out of battles where people were dying by the thousands and tens of thousands, and how human nature can bubble up even in these things. Later, Eisenhower, one of the great qualities of Eisenhower, is he knew how to manage these people. He knew how to manage them. I don't mean that condescendingly. He knew how to make it work, to bring it all together and make it work. Eisenhower later confided in a letter to General Marshall that the hardest part of his job was arranging the blankets smoothly over the several prima donnas who were in the same bed. In other words, to smooth all the feelings between Montgomery, Patton, Bradley, to smooth it all out. It takes a mature man. That's why Eisenhower was the man for the job. Proverbs chapter 16. Again, as we look through these things of history, many, many lessons jump out at us, brethren. And the great Battle of the Bulge, which turned out to be the greatest battle of World War II in the Western theater, of loss of men. And it wasn't even expected to happen. But anyway, going back at Montgomery and the human nature, how it shows itself here. Proverbs 16:32, we read, "He who rules his spirit is better than he who takes a city." He who rules the spirit is better than he who takes a city. Proverbs 25:28 says something very close to that. "Whoever has no rule over his own spirit is like a city broken down without walls." Like a city broken down without walls. So as great as some of these generals could be, they still would have trouble bringing the human nature as it is under control. So brethren, as we look at this, and there's more that we could go through, but we will cut it off here pretty quick anyway for the sake of time, that each one of those soldiers had a job to do. Each one of those soldiers had a job to do. My father-in-law had his job to do, and the men in that battalion had their job to do. And they did it. They didn't back away from it. Reminds me of that old adage I remember hearing as a kid, and I know I've mentioned it before, but how important are those little things? Most of you, I'm sure, have heard this at one time or another. For want of a nail, the shoe was lost. Never heard that one. Benjamin Franklin is the first one that I know of from my research that cited it. Where he got it, I don't know. But anyway, you think of a horse and a horseshoe. Get some understanding of what's being said here. For the want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For want of a shoe, the horse was lost. For want of a horse, the rider was lost. For want of a rider, the battle was lost. And for want of a battle, the kingdom was lost. And all for the want of a horseshoe nail. One horseshoe nail missing took out the horse, took out the rider, took out the battle, took out the kingdom. Ephesians 4, let's go to Ephesians. That each person, each soldier in this case, we're looking at the battle we're speaking of here, but bringing it back to where we live and dwell in our lives. Ephesians chapter 4, let's make our way there. And verse 1. I therefore, Paul in his letter here to the Ephesians, it says, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to have a walk worthy of the calling with which you were called, with all lowliness and gentleness, with longsuffering, bearing with one another in love. Bearing with one another in love. And let's go over now to verse 11, referring to Jesus. And he himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers. Why were these offices, gifts, however you want to classify that? Why were they given? Well, they're given for the equipping of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying. That word means building up. The purpose of it is for the building up of the body of Christ, of which the church of God is. Till we all come to the unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure and stature of the fullness of Christ, that we should no longer be children tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine by the trickery of men in the cunning craftiness by which they lie in wait to deceive, but speaking the truth in love may grow up in all things unto him who is the head, which is Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit. Remember we talked about the story about the nail missing from the shoe. You can apply that principle here as we read verse 16. From whom the whole body, the church, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working by which every part does its share. By which every part does its share. Or as Corey mentioned in the message, I think, said something about what is my role? What is my responsibility? What is my duty? What is my role? Verse 16 again. From whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective workings by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. Just like every trooper had his job when that onslaught began, every trooper had his job. Each member of the church of God has a responsibility and duty before God. Sometime you may have to sort that out before God, what that exactly that is, but there's something. You are a part of that body, as it said there in verse 16, again, from which the whole body joined and knit together. How is it knit together? By what every joint supplies. By what every joint supplies to it is what knits that body together. The whole body joined and knit together, according to the effective working by which every part does its share or fills its role. In the Battle of the Bulge, a whole lot of people did their share and considerably more.